So I'm using the word happiness here, which I think is that's a terrible word because it means something different to everyone, and therefore it makes it difficult to use it in a meaningful discussion. But so I'll use it here in the senses from this field called subjective well-being. So we don't yet, maybe we will never have good ways to actually measure how someone feels actually inside themselves. So in order to know how someone's feeling, you have to ask them. And this remains the state of the art in research and understanding how people feel. You ask them questions about how they're feeling, and then they tell you from their own subjective experience whether they're feeling good or bad or however. And so in this field of subjective well-being, they tend to break it down into three different kinds. So one of these is the cognitive evaluation of life. Basically, you ask some kind of question for somebody to evaluate how their life is going. There's the day-to-day feelings, also called affect. So it's just the emotional state from one moment to the next, one day to the next. Are you smiling, laughing, crying, that kind of thing? And then there is a trickier one that actually very few people seem to work on, but which is perhaps more related to, you know, really the role of religion. And one part of the role of religion is in the fulfillment of purpose, something called eudaimonia. But today I'm not going to talk about the second two. I'm just going to talk about the easiest one, I think, which is the cognitive life evaluation. So this has been the focus of something that you may have seen in the media. There's something that comes out every year called the World Happiness Report, which is very heavily publicized now. It's based on the Gallup World Poll, which has been going for 17 years now, I think, and which asks at least 1,000 people in every one of more than 150 countries a standard set of questions. So more than 1,000 people every year, and they repeat this every year, so it's a massive survey. They've asked millions of people these questions. So for me, as a kind of a data scientist, this is a very interesting thing to dig into. And I'm going to focus on the question that they choose, not because I like it particularly, but because this is what they've asked many people. And it's called Cantrell's Ladder. And the exact question is this. Please imagine a ladder with steps numbered from 0 at the bottom to 10 at the top. The top of the ladder represents the best possible life for you, and the bottom of the ladder represents the worst possible life for you. On which step of the ladder would you say you personally feel you stand at this time? So this is something you can privately answer for yourself in your own head if you would like to. But so this is the question that has been asked to millions of people through this Gallup World Poll, along with many other questions. You can then compare how people answer different questions to see what might be controlling how people evaluate their lives. So the results, there's lots of results to go through. Something that I think is very unfortunate is the way that they present these results. This is from the World Happiness Report. They presented this kind of World Cup of happiness or something. You know, it's really like a competition. Who's at the top? Who's doing the best in terms of happiness at the national level? Which I don't feel like is the right way to do it. But anyway, that's what they do. And so you always see these newspaper articles in the year, at the time of year that this is released, that tell you that, okay, this year Finland is the happiest country in the world. It usually goes between some northern European country to be the happiest country in the world. This is just the answer to that question that I showed you. So I think this is a very narrow view of happiness, which is really just this cognitive life evaluation according to that ladder scale, which is a weird question. But that's what they're talking about when they give you these rankings of what's the happiest country. And you can see there in the rankings at the top, so the bar is showing how happy the country is, the numbers are at the bottom there to tell you the score. And then there's an average for each country given after it. So I've just put here the top 13. You can see there, Canada usually does quite well. It's usually in the top 8. They're very consistent year to year. It's remarkable. You know, they ask a different few thousand people in each country every year, and the changes from year to year are very small in individual countries. There are changes, but they're very consistent. So it's interesting. You could argue about exactly what this means, but it means something because people answer the same way in these different countries. And Canada, right, so Canada's average is about 7.2, 7.4, somewhere in that year to year. And you can see the bottom countries are places that may not be surprising to have very low scores. They tend to be places with a lot of political instability, very poor infrastructure, things like this. And so those are the basic scores. And on here you can also see there's a the overall bars are broken down into colors that represent how much of the overall happiness can be explained by other things that are common to the population. So one of them is the material goods. You see that's down here at the bottom, the purple and orange. I don't know if you can see that. Can you see that?
No,
no, not really.
Read the top five.
Oh, sure, sorry. The top five are Finland, 7.6, and then Norway, Denmark, Iceland, Switzerland. And the bottom, well, the bottom seven here are Syria, Rwanda, Yemen, Tanzania, South Sudan, Central African Republic, and Burundi.
Where's the United States?
The United States, I think, was 18th this year. What the same as Costa Rica?
Oh, Canada.
Canada is seventh. After, so I went, I read the top five to Switzerland, then there's Netherlands, and then Canada, number seven. And the differences are very small, as you can see from the bars. So they're all kind of the same within air, they're pretty close. So Finland was 7.6, Canada was 7.3. So, but there's a huge difference between the top and the bottom. So all the top are pretty close together, but you know the countries with very low scores are much, much lower. So there is a huge range globally between Burundi, which has 2.9, and Finland, which has 7.6. So you can then try to explain these different scores from other things that you know about the population. So the purple and orange bars, it's kind of confusing, so I won't explain it, but they include GDP per capita and the life expectancy, which is an indicator of health of the population. So you could think of those as material things, material factors of the population. And then there's a bunch of questions that they ask that reflect non-material aspects of life in these countries. And so these are questions that relate to social support, how well people feel supported by their community. If they're free, they feel free to make life choices. If there tends to be a lot of charity within the country, and how corrupt the country is according to people's perceptions. So when they're asked how corrupt do they feel their society is. And so those are called non-material predictors. So the guy I did this work with is actually he was a particle physicist who then became a happiness economist. So when you talk to him, he's kind of like a robot. He's a very careful, mathematical, statistical guy. And so he did all the statistics on this. But basically, we repeated a similar exercise to what they did in the World Happiness Report and found similar results. And that we could, so this is showing now amongst all the countries how well you can predict the answer to that latter question of personal life evaluation from these variables, which I'm sorry, I just grabbed this figure from the paper. So this is the income is the first one. So this is the per capita income first. Then the life expectancy. So those first two are the material indicators. And then we have corruption, freedom to make choice, giving, charitable giving, and the sense of social support in the society. And the size of the bar here is showing how much of the difference between countries it can explain. So people have come up with results like this before, and you tend to see, well, you know, the material factors are pretty big. Those two bars are big, and the income bar tends to be the biggest. And this kind of has been a big part of the conversation about this, you know, that really we've got to increase the income of all these countries to make people happier. But we were interested in trying to look at how things have changed over the last 20 years for which this data has been available. Because people have now been asking these questions long enough that we can not just look at the static difference between countries, but we can see, okay, what makes a country become more or less happy over time, you know, according to how they answer this question. And we found that we could use these same proxy questions, you know, the non-material and the material factors, to predict changes. So not just the difference between countries, but how they change over time. And that's what this plot's showing. So this plot's showing how well can we, with our statistical model, estimate the observed change in countries over the last 20 years compared to what actually happened. And I won't explain the details of this plot, but I'll just say if it were perfect, if we had perfect predictability, then all of these circles would fall on that black diagonal line. And they don't, because it's a hard thing to do. but it's statistically very significant. So we can get something like 70% of the changes in how people answer this question about their life evaluation. We can get 70% of that from how income changes, how social support changes, how generosity changes over time. Does that make sense? So then what we do is we say, okay, what could happen going into the future? Obviously, it's very difficult to predict what could happen in the future. We're not trying to do that. We're not trying to predict. We're trying to say, what's the range of what could happen, taking what we've seen over the last 20 years as a guide to what seems feasible? So we use everything that's happened in the world and these 150 countries over the last 20 years to tell us what seems like it could happen, and then we project that forward to the year 2100. So, well, it's actually, we use 15 years. So we use 15 years, assume that this tells us something about the range of possible, well, not necessarily possible, but feasible changes over the next 30 years. And then this gives us a range for what things could look like in terms of global life evaluations in 2050. So when we do this, I'll just cut to the answer. This is what we find. So for the material trends, so this is for the income and the life expectancy, we looked both at how things have changed within countries over the last 15 years, and also the OECD, so this is a standard thing made by economists, for how they think income distributions will change around the world going forward in the future. We used their optimistic and their pessimistic versions, and we come up with this range. So here you can see there's a little arrow on the bottom. The arrow on the bottom shows the global average life evaluation today of 5.2. Today's global average of 5.2. And so we think that if you just had the material changes, you just had the projected increases in income that are generally thought to be coming in the future around the world, from either the OECD or the material trends, you'd get a small increase. So that's good. It suggests that we could get a small increase in how people are feeling just from economic improvements going into the future. But then if you look at the non-material trends, so if you look at the range of how things can change on these more societal indicators, there's a huge range, tremendous. I mean, much bigger, a factor of 4 bigger than the economic changes. So, and somewhat concerningly, these go from very positive, from everybody becoming much happier, to quite negative, everybody becoming much less happy.
Can you just mention the colors, Eric? It's easier to see than the
Sure. Yeah. So the orange at the top, that doesn't really matter. The orange and the purple are the material world projections, and the green at the bottom is the non-material world. And just for reference, the non-material trends take you from something like modern-day Egypt or India up to modern-day Belgium or the United States levels. So it seems like you could have the whole world go towards either one of those extremes, depending on what happens to the nature of society. So, and I'll just very quickly say, so I said before that income seems to have a very strong role in these material things, and yet here when we look forward into the future, its role is quite small in terms of what could feasibly happen over the next 30 years. And the answer is pretty simple. It's just because material trends are pretty homogeneous. When you look at different countries, this is now showing different countries over the 15-year period, they're still kind of going up a bit. And there's not much range. So the income is not going to go, it's very unlikely that it's going to skyrocket or do anything weird. This seems to be quite stably increasing, actually, around the world. Whereas non-material trends are all over the place. So this is showing a bunch of countries with very large changes. So this is going from 0.8 down to 0.4. This is on a scale of 0 to 1. So this is changing over half the possible range within individual countries over this period. So it's just when you look at these, how much these very important societal characteristics can change within countries, it's huge. So this is actually the freedom of choice variable, and the countries shown here maybe I'll tell you a couple. So Venezuela is the one in blue, showing this huge nosedive. Pakistan shows this U shape, the green one that goes way down and bounces up again. Iraq shows this large increase from 2012 through 2016. So the important point here really is just that these societal variables can change like crazy. And so even though they explain less of the variation between country, they're likely to play a more important role in what could happen going forward into the future. So just to finish off with a map here, so here this is, hopefully you can see this, is mapping out the global answer to this question of the Cantrell's ladder all around the world today, or in 2017. So you can see the color scale there, so the orange places, this is actually shaded according to the population density. So this actually shows you the life evaluation of people where they live. So if the colors are darker, that's because there's more people living there. But then the shade is going from very, very low evaluations in red to very high evaluations in blue. So that's what it looks like today. If we look at the optimistic, feasible futures, the world could look something like this in 2050, mostly dependent on how societal characteristics change. Or the world could look something like this in 2050 if society goes in the worst directions that we've seen happening within individual countries over the last 15 years. Yeah. So I think the moral of the story is we should tell our leaders not to worry so much about the economy, and we should be much more concerned about the nature of our societies being closer together and having communities like this one that give people social support and strengthen these very important features of human well-being.